While Have You Heard This One is on hiatus, we wanted to share another show that we think you might like. From KUOW comes Let the Kids Dance, which tells the story of the time when Seattle decided to take a page out of the Footloose playbook and try to stop kids from having fun. If you like what you hear, find the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
It's a frigid winter night in Seattle. The city is cocooned in the deep dark of another Pacific Northwest winter. But the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union Hall is radiating like a furnace. The heroes of Seattle's rock and roll underground are here playing an all-ages show.
It was a sellout. Many were left outside, willing to buy tickets, but there were no more tickets to be found.
It's a spectacle. News cameras, police cruisers, a street party. Inside, Blood Brothers, Botch, and Murder City Devils, they're just about torching the place.
It got really, really hot in there. It's so hot that the sweat from the bodies started producing up on the ceiling, and it started raining inside the venue.
I think that show was the first time I was like, holy shit, like, these kids are out of their minds.
Tonight's concert is breaking a citywide tension that's been building for years. Tonight, January 27th, 2001, is a victory party.
A couple of hours ago, there was a line to get in that went around the building, and many teens here say that should send a message.
For almost two decades, a law called the Teen Dance Ordinance has been strangling Seattle's music scene. The TDO banned anyone under 18 from attending concerts or dance parties without a parent or guardian. It made shows like this one illegal.
If they want to keep kids off drugs and kids off, like, wandering on the streets, give us something to do. You know, I'm 16 years old and I can't do anything. It's like, you want us to stay at home and smoke weed? Or do you want us to go out and, like, dance around and have fun?
Seattle punks have been fighting for the right to participate in the music scene they helped create. They've battled politicians, parents, even cops in the streets. And tonight, the punks win. They're throwing this rager, and City Hall is paying for it.
Just the enthusiasm was off the hook.
This is the chaos that was happening just for a show. And we had, at the same time, this political context happening all around us.
Yes, what we have here is the plot of the movie Footloose, in real life, in Seattle.
Seattle downtown has so much, a great nightlife for everybody but underage kids.
The kids here, man, we're bored.
Not anymore. For the first time in years, the kids are cutting loose guilt-free. All we need is Kevin Bacon in the mosh pit.
Seattle was never what the world thought it was. When the Nirvana album broke in 1991 and the world descended on Seattle and every band wanted to be Nirvana and every club had grunge-like, Nirvana-like, post-grunge clones playing every night, it was never what the world thought it was because the undercurrent was always the Teen Dance Ordinance.
Just the name, Teen Dance Ordinance. If you put it in fiction, anyone reading it would be like, that's a little much.
It was so clear by that point that there was an amazing music scene happening at the city, but it was also really clear to me that I wasn't really invited.
The story of Seattle music is amazing. You know the bands, the songs, the stars. This stuff is pop culture mythology.
Let the kids dance. Let the kids dance.
But to this day, the story is incomplete. The part where Seattle persecuted its own music community while it was becoming the thing the city would forever be known for, we just don't talk about that part. So, what happened? How did a city, especially a city like Seattle, become convinced that music and dancing were an existential threat to its youth? And why did it take nearly 20 years to change people's minds? From KUOW in Seattle, I'm Jonathan Zwickel, and this is Let the Kids Dance.
It
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is a meeting of the city's Public Safety Committee.
On July 29th, 1985, in a unanimous vote, the Seattle City Council passed Ordinance 112373, the Teen Dance Ordinance.
For our licenses, the operation of dance clubs open to persons under the age of 18.
The opening sentence reads, City Council hereby finds and declares that the pervasive problems of runaway children, drug abuse, and abuse of children are problems of such magnitude that they are a matter of city concern and are contributed to by unregulated dance halls. As such, this chapter shall regulate dance halls that admit persons under the age of 18. Runaway children, drug abuse, unregulated dance halls. Clearly, lawmakers in Seattle were feeling some serious pent-up anxiety. Social norms had grown tenuous throughout the 20th century as new, youth-driven subcultures offered more channels for self-expression, and the TDO was an awkward, desperate response. Back in 1985, Seattle was comfortably rough around the edges, a place that kept to itself in the far-left corner of the continent. Young people knew there was cool, weird stuff thriving beneath the surface. Gay dance clubs, new-wave dive bars, underground punk and metal shows, teen discos. Amid this flourishing underground, by far the wildest thing going was the monastery. And the monastery would change the landscape of Seattle forever. In its heyday, the monastery was famous up and down the West Coast, an all-ages, after-hours nightclub that was also an actual church run by an actual pastor. His name was George Freeman. Freeman was a polarizing figure in Seattle, either Caligula or Christ, depending on your point of view. The stories about the monastery, they're complicated. Freeman is complicated. He's praised for shepherding a flock of outcasts who found joy and community under his roof. He's blamed for knowingly putting teens in harm's way. However you see it, there's no doubt Freeman and the monastery triggered Seattle's adult population like little before or since.
Hello, George.
Today, George Freeman is 85 years old. He agreed to an interview, but it had to be at his home. Producer Matt Martin and I show up on a Tuesday afternoon.
Maybe we should go up the stairs
yeah.
and see if he's there. This might be like
the wedding?
The disco chapel part of the house.
If you've driven through Seattle, you've seen George Freeman's house. It's the four-story glass tower on the edge of Capitol Hill that overlooks I-5. In the afternoon, its facade reflects the glare of the setting sun. At night, it's lit up with garish neon. Maybe you've noticed the sign that reads, Science is God, or the life-size astronaut in the window. When Freeman hosts his massive parties for July 4th and Pride, the spotlights and laser beams are visible across Lake Union.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Find anything?
Well, I've found a lot of things. This place is full of incredible bits and pieces.
We follow Freeman inside. We take the glass tube elevator to the third floor while Freeman takes the spiral plexiglass staircase. We arrive at the kitchen and dining area, adjacent to a pair of glass-walled bathrooms. The circular dining table is set under what looks like a fluffy white cloud embedded into the ceiling. This is where we sit and talk.
This is a dream. I made it. It's out of a dream. I got a glass house. Very little did I know that this is where life would take me.
Freeman wears a fleece vest over a button-down shirt and a black U.S. Army ball cap. He looks and moves like a man 15 years his junior. Regular guy, relaxed, in good health. These days, he's best known as the presiding chaplain of the Universal Life Church. Yes, that Universal Life Church. Freeman claims to have ordained some 20 million Americans online, giving license to countless unconventional wedding ceremonies over the last 20 years. The Universal Life Church motto is, "We are all children of the same universe." It's posted on every page of the website. Today, I see it all over Freeman's house. That motto was also inscribed over the front door of the monastery, the nightclub that Freeman opened in Seattle in 1977. The same one the city shut down by court order in 1985.
Why what? What is all this about? Why has the city gone crazy over the monastery?
Why did the city go crazy over the monastery? What did Freeman do to be declared a public nuisance by a county judge? Outside the dining room, day turns to night. The glass house darkens and mood lighting comes up, casting Freeman's face in greens, purples, and pinks. his recollections veer into elaborate digressions. Sometimes they wind back to the original plot and sometimes not. His memory is sharp but inconsistent. Throughout our conversation, I try to glean as much truth as I can, not only from what he says, but also by the way he says it. George Freeman grew up in Spokane, Washington, passed between the homes of extended family members and the local group home for children. He joined the National Guard as a teen in the 1950s and later the U.S. Army, which stationed him around the world. He says he left the military in 63, when his superiors forbid him and other black soldiers to serve at Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington. He made his way to New York in the early 70s, where he started throwing parties in his Greenwich Village apartment.
First, I did parties in my apartment, and I would charge $1 or $2. I'd get kegs. I had two projectors in the bedroom, and I'd get naughty films. I'd play the naughty films in the bedroom. I would buy big bags of popcorn, so there was popcorn all over, and cold beer. And I gave the doorman $200 or $300, so he was happy. And I invited all the neighbors in my building. So therefore, it was a huge party. I had 400 people in a two-bedroom apartment.
With the success of his apartment parties, Freeman's ambitions grew. In 1973, he and a few investors opened a nightclub in Lower Manhattan, Galaxy 21. It was one of the most extravagant nightclubs in New York at the time, a precursor to Studio 54. Accounts describe thousands of people showing up to dance all night until the next day. Glamorous, mostly gay, super stylish, celebrities and wannabes. The soundtrack was provided by DJ Walter Gibbons, the man credited with inventing the remix. There's no other way to say it. George Freeman is one of the architects of dance music culture in America. After a few high-flying years, Freeman and his landlords came to an intractable financial disagreement. Rather than argue with powerful people who may have been in league with the mafia, Freeman got out. He wanted to start another nightclub somewhere, and he had cousins in Seattle. He moved back to Washington, and he brought some of New York with him.
I got the doorman, the sound guy, the disc jockey, and I think two other people from New York to come out.
So wait, before that happened, you had to find this space. So there was an abandoned church, an empty church.
So I saw that church, and I says, oh, shit, look at this. I always wanted to do a bank or a church. I always thought a bank or a church would be fabulous.
The symbolism there.
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw the church, and I walked into it, and I looked at it, and I says, oh, God.
Freeman signed the lease on the 70-year-old former Methodist church in the Denny Triangle neighborhood in 1977. Today, it's where Seattle's brand new convention center is. He registered it with the city as a church and his own private residence, a designation with dual purposes. As a religious institution, the monastery wasn't regulated or taxed like a nightclub or other place of business. And because it was his home, Freeman could serve alcohol to adult guests legally and freely. On opening night, Freeman flew in the DJ in a helicopter that landed across the street from the club. The DJ emerged dressed in monk's robes. He strolled past onlookers through the doors of the monastery and started a party that lasted for, well, for years. That music you hear, that's DJ Dana Andrews playing the monastery's Red Party in 1983. His blend of outer space funk, soul, and disco moved dancers night after night. Music, according to Freeman, has a higher power.
It's tones. It's mathematical numbers. And when you do that to us, we respond. Doom. Okay. The mind tells the body, tap into that. And that's where I came to the realization that the music is a message. If you want to cure people of things and make them feel good, make them dance every fucking week, all night long.
At the ground floor was a spacious dance floor and a DJ booth with turntables suspended from the ceiling, all framed by stained glass windows. Above the dance floor was dark mezzanine seating, and on the basement level, more dark lounge space with an airplane seat movie theater and a private hot tub known as the baptismal pool. Throughout it all, the music was inescapable.
This was my first experience of hearing that club four on the floor kit drum that you would hear before you even went inside. That was my first time experiencing it, which is still an experience I love. I love going to clubs.
Conrad Asklund was 15 years old the first time he went to the monastery. He worked at a nearby restaurant, and an older coworker invited him along.
I remember the smell of sweat because people were dancing so hard. And then when you get into the back areas, I remember kind of a funky smell back there, which is probably what you imagine it was.
The crowd was queer, self-described outcasts, freaks, weirdos, teens seeking a daring night out, 20-something holdouts from the disco days. Dress was flamboyant. Lots of shiny black leather and new wave looks worn by proto-goth kids known as bat cavers. More than 1,000 people might pour through over the course of a weekend, usually arriving after midnight.
The people dancing were so free, and a lot of it probably, you know, drug-fueled, ecstasy and things like that. It was almost like a French Marquis de Sade era party. It was just so over the top, the way people were dancing and interacting with each other. They were all just dancing together, just one community. And it was a place where I felt like I belonged for the first time, because there was no judgment.
The party would go on until dawn. In the morning, Freeman would serve breakfast. Conrad was bullied in high school for what he describes as his effeminate manner. The monastery felt different. It felt like family.
For me, it was just a place where I didn't get teased, but for a lot of people, this was the only place they could survive.
You can find tons of similar sentiments online. First-person recollections from former regulars describing the monastery as the setting for the best nights of their young lives. Testimony to how significant this place was to so many people. Freeman was in his mid-40s back then. During the day, he opened the monastery to teens with nowhere else to go. Many were runaways and sex workers. Back then, teenage homelessness was a serious problem in the region. A 1972 count found more than 5,000 homeless young people in King County. Life on the streets came with very real dangers. Between 1982 and 84, the Green River Killer murdered 40-some young women, most of them sex workers he picked up off the streets of Seattle. Street life was scary, but so was the monastery's reputation. Along with the tolerant atmosphere were rumors of sexual abuse and prostitution, easy access to hard drugs.
Every once in a while, you'd hear about an overdose or someone got arrested by the police. And I remember having the thought that not all of us are going to get out of this experience.
Police had their eye on the club starting just 5 months after it opened. In October 1977, the SPD raided the place and brought more than 200 people downtown. All of them were released. Only three were charged with any sort of crime, including Freeman, for providing alcohol without a license. Freeman claimed he was unjustly targeted and harassed by police. Undercover cops continued infiltrating the monastery over the years. Some later testified they witnessed patrons and staff selling marijuana and amphetamines. Only a handful of arrests were ever made for drug sales. No one was ever charged for sexual crimes. But allegations of illicit behavior hovered over the place.
So how do you reconcile the sort of dark and light sides of that reality, of what the monastery offered?
I guess I don't really reconcile it. I take this partly as the experience of adolescence.
Yeah, wow. It just seems like such a collision of contradictions and experiences.
A contradiction, yeah, because it was, I guess in what I'm saying, you know, the monastery was beautiful and horrendously ugly at the same time, depending on how you're slicing that experience.
One monastery regular I spoke with wouldn't go on the record, but they told me they were molested by adults in this environment that built itself as a safe place. They said certain adults groomed children, solicited them for sex. I couldn't corroborate their story, but I asked Freeman about it.
And I've heard that before, and I know of people that we would not let in because of that. But I also look at it as a two-part story, and I ask myself, when did you know you were gay? And what straight kid, I mean, if you don't have an attraction for a man, regardless of what age you are,
you don't continue. You run away and scream. One time, okay, but the second time, or you keep going back, says that you were a hustler making money, or you enjoyed sex, and you were gay or bisexual.
Freeman seems to be blaming the victim here. He's heard similar allegations for 40 years and has made similar denials every time. He said that the age of consent in Seattle back then was 16, and the Bible puts the age of exoneration when a child becomes an adult at 13. Freeman himself was charged with indecent liberties in 1981 in Spokane, nearly 300 miles away from the monastery. This was around the time he operated an all-ages disco there called Waterworks. He pled guilty to fourth-degree simple assault, but we couldn't find any more details about the incident. After wading through endless newspaper accounts, personal anecdotes, and police reports, the only thing I can confidently tell you about the monastery is it defies a single defining narrative. The stories about it are contradictory, obscured by nostalgia or trauma, the haze of late nights and heavy drugs. And a place where thousands of people spent thousands of hours in intoxicated, unsupervised conditions, anything was possible. The mystery of the monastery made it a lightning rod. The hellscape visions of parents, police, and policymakers were likely exaggerated, but some concern was legitimate. Freeman was indeed pushing boundaries, and in the process, he may have tainted the very idea of a safe space for all-ages music and dancing. To further complicate the situation, the late 1970s saw a surge of anti-disco backlash. Rock and rollers from coast to coast spurned the music and all its trappings. Beneath the public burnings of disco records ran a sinister undercurrent. See, disco culture was originally made by and for queer people of color. The music, the fashion, the dancing. As it gained popularity, distaste for the style often covered latent homophobia and racism. These days we see similar prejudice against drag performance, which masks a similar unspoken fear. These queer people are coming for our children. The monastery was the most visible of the teen discos in Seattle, but there were others, and they were all popular hangouts and targets for police. By the mid-1980s, incidents at these places were piling up. A stabbing, a shooting, citations for underage drinking. Freeman himself had been found guilty of multiple liquor violations. Local news kept the city apprised of the situation, drawing all sorts of negative attention to the all-ages club scene. It was a time of intersecting moral panics. Gay music on the airwaves, pedophiles in the dance clubs, runaway drug addicts on the streets. All of it intersected at George Freeman's monastery. Caught up alongside were the young people of Seattle. One exasperated dad had enough. A suburban attorney named David Crosby. He founded a parents' rights lobbying group called Parents in Arms. And with hundreds of supporters behind him, he went after the monastery.
The question is it dangerous for these kids to be in the clubs all night long? I submit that that is demonstrably so. I certainly don't believe this. One of the owners of the clubs has said that attending the dance hall is no different from getting an ice cream sundae at Denny's. Now, that's absurd, and we all know it's absurd.
In the summer of 1985, David Crosby would get his way. After the break, Parents in Arms attacks the monastery. And from the wreckage, the Teen Dance Ordinance is born. At the monastery, pounding music and flashing lights dazzled the senses. Unchecked hedonism created an autonomous zone separate from the outside world. All of it was bound up by that philosophy of unity painted over the entrance. We are all children of the same universe. George Freeman preached the word to his flock. In order to keep the monastery's status as a religious institution and to maintain his tax breaks, he had to give a nightly sermon. He would pause the party at 2 a.m. and address the assembled revelers on the dance floor.
Didn't want to do it, but I knew that it was necessary for the courts.
Did you give the sermon?
You can say anything you want to say. You can talk about love, you can talk about anything you want. You've unified the tribe, and the tribe's ready to dance because you've got the thing the tribe came for. We danced. I took the monastery back to the 14th century of when the church was that. And the city couldn't see that.
Freeman believed he could instill his utopian vision on the people of Seattle. But with all its conflicting impulses, Seattle wouldn't comply. Freeman remained strident in his defense of the monastery as a place of refuge, and in his belief that he was targeted because of his race.
White clubs were never abated. Who was abated? Me and Oscar's, a black restaurant down at the bottom of the hill where now it's the Safeway.
David Crosby didn't buy it. His hostility toward the club arose from personal experience. He described the situation to the Seattle Times. His teenage son started skipping school, hanging out with a different crowd. He listened to David Bowie and Iggy Pop, grew out a mohawk, and ran away from home. Crosby learned that the boy was spending his time on the streets or at the monastery. He'd heard the rumors about the place and was terrified for his son's safety. By 1985, Crosby's Parents in Arms lobbying group had grown to more than 200 members. Parents in Arms spawned counterfactions. Youth in Arms and Kids in Action were made up of monastery regulars. They spoke positively about Freeman and the club to anyone who'd listen. The constant controversy around the monastery made it a magnet for local media.
Freeman called the place a church, but to King County prosecutors, it was a public nuisance, a teen disco where drug, alcohol, and sex abuse were common. The county wants to prevent Freeman from ever opening another place like the monastery.
Thanks to the nonstop coverage, the perception of Freeman as a degenerate grew.
I would go in the supermarkets and, oh, are you George Freeman? And I'd get this snarly look. I had people coming down, Christians coming down, laying hands on the building to cast out the demons. At one time, I must be honest with you, I did sincerely think of going in the tower, setting it on fire, and dying in there.
Freeman was exhausted. The club was under constant surveillance. But despite their continued efforts, police couldn't pin any serious criminal charges. So David Crosby changed tactics. He enlisted the aid of King County prosecuting attorney Norm Maleng, who believed the club could be shut down as a public nuisance by a civil suit. The monastery was hit with a temporary restraining order. Then Freeman's landlord refused to renew the lease on the church. And in the summer of 1985, Norm Maleng brought George Freeman to King County Court.
The monastery actively fosters an environment that encourages the sexual exploitation of children, that after ingestion of drugs and alcohol, they are regularly exposed to an environment where sexual acts are openly performed, where offers to engage in acts of prostitution are made, and where lewd acts are common.
Freeman elected to forego an attorney and defend himself.
The monastery is no different than any other gospel mission or school coliseum, Paramount Theater, or Golden Gardens or Alki Beach. The issue of exploitation and pandering for lewd purposes that the state alleges is completely false.
Freeman's claim that the monastery was just like any other popular concert venue or public place didn't land. After 10 days and 46 witnesses for and against, the court gave its verdict.
A judge declared the monastery a public nuisance after reports of illegal drug use and sexual activity. The doors of the monastery are closed, shut down by a court order, and by a landlord who wouldn't renew George Freeman's lease.
David Crosby went even further. He convinced Reverend Kirby Hensley, the founder of the original Universal Life Church, to cut ties with Freeman. Reverend Hensley even testified against him at trial.
He has no longer connected with the Universal Life Church, and it's completely stopped because we're definitely against minors being in there and it twisted and things like that, so he was canceled out.
The ULC revoked Freeman's charter. He'd later go on to start his own version, Universal Life Church Monastery, the one that got rich doing online ordinations for the likes of Conan O'Brien and The Rock. But that was still years off.
The monastery was almost deserted this morning as the club's garish lights reflected onto an empty dance floor. Owner George Freeman was busy trying to sell those lights and anything else he could.
On top of it all, liquor violations from 1981 and 83 came back to haunt Freeman after his appeals failed. Freeman fled to California, but was picked up in Alameda and returned to Seattle. He was sentenced to 10 months in King County Jail and served 7. David Crosby got his man, but he wasn't done policing all-ages nightlife. He used Freeman's criminal record to further his crusade.
But George Freeman, who is the owner of the monastery, has been convicted 3 times serving liquor in that establishment without a license. He has pled guilty to assault on a minor in Spokane, and he has been convicted of armed robbery in the states of New Jersey and New York. Now, if you're telling me that we can't take that into consideration when we decide whether or not that man should have a license to entertain our children, then as a poet once said, the law is an ass.
According to a Newsweek article from 1974, Freeman was involved in 8 holdups over a 2-week period and arrested in 1965. He served 4.5 years in jail. And as far as the indecent liberties conviction in Spokane, he was convicted of a misdemeanor, but the court record doesn't state the age of the victim. Maybe it was inevitable that when a guy like George Freeman arrived in a city with his own way of doing things, he was going to get squashed by the powers that be. It's likely that he was a victim of targeted racism and homophobia, and that terrible things happened at his nightclub on his watch. He built a sanctuary for inclusion, and it included people with ill intent. Crosby had gotten close to important people in city government, like Councilmember Norm Rice. Back then, Greg Nichols was Rice's rookie assistant.
There was a fella, a dad of one of the kids who hung out there, who was a local attorney and very passionately lobbying to have rules put into place to protect his son and kids like that. And he was very, very effective, and he got the ear of my boss.
Crosby and Rice partnered with King County Prosecutor Norma Lang, Seattle City Attorney Doug Jewett, and other members of the city council. Together, they concocted legislation they believed would protect Seattle's youth from the dangers of teen dance clubs. The law would prevent a place like the Monastery from ever existing again.
And that ultimately led to the teen dance ordinance, which in my opinion, and I shared this at the time with my boss, not publicly, was an overreaction. It went way too far based on one place that was sketchy.
The thing is, this wasn't the first time city leaders criminalized dancing. Seattle has a long history of using laws to navigate between permissive and reactionary extremes. And since its earliest days, it's been especially conflicted about nightlife and the activities that go with it. In the early 1900s, the Seattle district known as the Lava Beds held the largest concentration of vice in America. This is the place where the term Skid Row was coined. Corrupt city officials built a 500-room bordello they boasted was the biggest in the world. The state responded by criminalizing alcohol sales. In 1916, yes, Washington was so eager for sobriety and propriety that it jumped into prohibition 4 years before the rest of the country. Toward the end of the 1920s, a new form of cheap entertainment arrived in Seattle, the dance marathon. These were competitive feats of endurance that brought out young couples to Foxtrot or Charleston for days, weeks, and even months on end. One 15-minute break every 24 hours. The first and only dance marathon in Seattle started on July 23, 1928. A week in, a woman was punched in the face by her dance partner. Lack of sleep had likely driven the man hysterical. The term for it was gone squirrely. When the contest ended after 19 days, the woman took fifth place, then went home and tried to kill herself. The Seattle City Council immediately banned dance marathons. Flash forward to the 1960s, when the city's nascent counterculture left behind sock hops and roller skating parties for all-night rock concerts. This is the scene where young Jimi Hendrix played his first gigs. As young people further embraced nightlife, once again, civic leaders assumed the worst. Dancing was dangerous. In 1967, they passed legislation that barred people under 18 years old from attending dances without a legal guardian. They called it the Teenage Dance Ordinance. Newspaper reports from the time said the language was vague. It didn't define what a dance is versus, say, a concert. The power of enforcement it gave police was too broad. Perhaps because it was poorly designed, or because it just wasn't effective, the law was never enforced and quickly forgotten. But you can see where this is going. Almost two decades later, the Monastery had stoked old fears. Someone had to do something. Seattle Mayor Norm Rice and his allies dug up the old 1967 dance ordinance, stitched the wording into a much more restrictive bill, and gave it virtually the same name. In late June, Rice took the new teen dance ordinance to the city council for a vote.
The sheer number of kids who are attracted to the clubs shows convincingly the need for the outlet the clubs provide. The need for the outlet argues for reasonable regulation, not against it. Parents, kids, neighbors must be confident that the clubs are safe, responsibly managed places where kids can go and enjoy rather than being exploited inside or outside the club.
The new ordinance stated that anyone hosting a teenage dance or music event with more than 150 people would need to be licensed. People under 16 years old attending such an event would have to be accompanied by an adult, same as those under 18 after 2 a.m. Police officers would have full access on any occasion. The city would be indemnified from any damages incurred at venues. Then there were the expenses. Licensed promoters would have to pay for a comprehensive liability insurance policy worth at least $1 million. They'd also be required to hire two or more off-duty police officers to provide security and pay their hourly rates. After Rice's opening statement, Nichols read the proposed bill to the people in the room.
First, the minimum age for entrance has been increased from 14 to 16. That's the age at which you can enter without a parent.
Before the vote, the floor was open to public debate. Young people, parents, nightlife professionals, and school administrators all weighed in for and against.
Speaking to the monastery and the alleged problems purportedly that came from the monastery and its attendant publicity, clearly this ordinance is not necessary to address those problems.
There are frequently young men in their 20s with cars and generous availability of drugs, alcohol, and free rides, or a corrupting influence any way you care to define that. It's not uncommon for 14 and 15-year-old girls, sometimes boys, to sample three or four different types of drugs in one person's car.
Many of our members can look upon their children's attendance at teen clubs as a major milestone in the development of more serious problems.
John Schlorett, who owned Club Broadway, another all-ages dance club, lobbied against the TDO.
I really feel that it's been a tremendous job of McCarthyism on the part of Parents in Arms. It, right here in the Weekly, an article written by David Crosby, in my opinion, public enemy number one in the current Seattle runaway crisis is the teenage discotheque.
Schlorett points out the massive fallacy that city officials were walking into. They were attempting to fix the issue of teen homelessness by clamping down on nightclubs. Public comment lasted for almost 3 hours. In the end, it all fell back on that old impulse to protect the children.
If this council concludes that there is a danger to these children out there, then it has not only the right, but the obligation to do something about it.
The council agreed. On July 29, 1985, in a unanimous vote, they passed Ordinance 112373. The era of the teen dance ordinance had begun. They didn't realize it at the time, but city officials had signed the death warrant for Seattle's all-ages music scene.
The TDO was not intended, I don't believe, to shut clubs down, other than possibly the monastery, but rather to set up some structure around which clubs could operate. The problem is that the assumptions behind it turned out not to be correct, and there wasn't a way for an all-ages club to operate with those rules.
Young people were paying attention. Musicians were too. They saw the TDO for what it was and what it would do. It didn't just make hosting dances and concerts cost prohibitive. It also cast teenagers, dancing, and music in a debased and distrustful light.
That's why the teen dance ordinance was maddening. You're not being trusted as a teenager. You're told, no, it's not safe for you. And that it just wasn't true.
If you're robbing kids of the opportunity to experience live music, that's critical. They're in those formative years. They're like growing into who they are.
This is all the result of this totally unnecessary, totally absurd legislation.
Seattle can be liberating and it can be frustrating. I've spent the last 17 years writing about the city's creative community for almost every publication in town. I'm also on the board of directors of an all-ages concert venue here called the Vera Project. I keep a close eye on Seattle's all-ages community. All-ages music is the oxygen that keeps the whole thing healthy. It supplies fresh ideas, new fans and artists, and a spirit of passionate participation. Going back through the decades, so many of the artists the world identifies with Seattle launched from all-ages spaces. the same all-ages spaces that Seattle criminalized. Back at the end of the 20th century, up in the top left corner of the country, a culture clash was inevitable. The survival of free expression and of the music and art the whole world knows and loves was far from guaranteed. Resistance to the TDO started immediately. Young people came together to protest the new law, to fight for their value as artists and as human beings. The road ahead was long, longer than anyone realized, but they were determined to drag Seattle into a new era, not kicking and screaming, but headbanging and crowd surfing. In our next episode, Seattle police begin enforcing the TDO, and they're not kind about it.
As you came out, there was an officer here, there was two officers here, and they would run up and hit people as they came out the door.
Punks battle cops in the street to stand up for their music. The most repressive era for teenagers in Seattle's history is just beginning. For KUOW in Seattle, I'm Jonathan Zwickel, and this is Let the Kids Dance. Let the Kids Dance is a production of KUOW in Seattle. We're a member of the NPR Network, a coalition of independent, listener-supported public media podcasts. Let the Kids Dance is created and written by me, Jonathan Zwickel. Matt Martin produced the show. Jim Gates is our editor. Final mixing by Hans Twite. Special thanks to University of Washington Archive and Cairo 7 for their TV footage. Our production team includes Marshall Eisen, Michaela Giannotti-Boyle, Marion Muhammad, Brendan Sweeney, and Lauren Vespoli. Hey listeners, do you like going to all-ages shows? Did you when you were younger? Did you live through the teen dance ordinance in Seattle? Or were you part of an all-ages scene somewhere else? Tell us about it. Record a voice message on your phone and email it to dance@kuow.org. Thanks for listening.